When Ray Price was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1996, he was described by Kris Kristofferson as a living link from Hank Williams to the country music of today. Price was Hank Williams' protege and roommate in the early 50s after Price moved to Nashville. Soon after, Price helped give several country performers their starts. Early in their careers, Willie Nelson, Roger Miller, Johnny Paycheck, and Johnny Bush played in Price's band, the Cherokee Cowboys. Price was born in Cherokee County, Texas in 1926. His country hits have included Crazy Arms, Release Me, Heartaches by the Number, and For the Good Times. Price is still performing, and next month the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville will honor the 80-year-old honky-tonk singer with an exhibit devoted to his life and music. The exhibit will run until next June. Terry spoke with Ray Price in 1999. Before we hear their conversation, here's Ray Price's version of Ramblin' Rose.
Ramblin' Rose, Ramblin' Rose, why you ramble, no one knows. Wild and windblown, that's how you've grown. Who can cling to a rambling rose? Ramble on, ramble on. When you're rambling, days are gone. Who will love you with a love true? When you're rambling, days are gone. Ramblin' Rose, Ramblin' Rose.
Let's talk a little bit about your past. I know you grew up in Texas. Where did you grow up, and what was that community like?
Well, I came from Northeast Texas, which was then Wood County and Upshur County. It's a rural area, and my family were all farmers on both sides. And then my mother and dad moved to Dallas, and of course I went to Dallas with them. And I was raised in Dallas and went to college in Arlington, Texas. So it's a pretty part of the state.
One of the people who helped you a lot early in your career was Hank Williams, the great country singer. How did you meet him?
Well, the music publisher in Nashville, who got me a contract with Columbia Records, got me on one of Hank's radio shows. Every Friday night in Nashville, they would, if the stars were in town, they would be on their own radio shows at WSM in Nashville. And I was a guest. The music publisher, Troy Martin, had gotten me in a spot on his show, and I met him. And we became real close friends, and he got me on the Grand Ole Opry. And he and his wife were getting divorced, and
Williams got you on the Grand Ole Opry.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And then we lived together. We had a house there in Nashville, and I had the upstairs. He had the lower for about a year, and then, of course, he passed away.
And you're saying that you started living together after he and his wife separated?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had to have somebody. He had a problem with alcohol, and we were real close, and I'd take care of him. Everything was fine.
What would you do for him?
Oh, just whatever needed to be done, like go to the store and things like that.
Would you try to keep him from alcohol or keep him comfortable with it? Or?
Well, yeah, but you just don't do. Oh, no, I wouldn't give him anything. No way. But, yeah, like any of your friends, if they got into it too far, you'd try to help them if they were ill.
Now, I read someplace, and you could tell me if this is true, because there's so many legends surrounding famous people, but I read that Hank Williams tried to shoot you a couple of times, that he shot at you a couple of times.
No, honey, that is a real big prevarication.
Okay.
Real big. No way.
Okay.
It had to come from somebody that may have been a little envious back there somewhere.
Right.
It really didn't happen. The reason why that Hank and I stopped living together right at the last was the fact that he was in the hospital so many times and having so much trouble. And one of the times I was ordered by the man, Jim Denny, who ran the Artist Service Bureau in Nashville, and handled Hank to take him to the hospital. And Hank got a little ill at me for that, and so I moved. But we never lost the friendship we had.
Did he help you get on the Grand Ole Opry the first time?
Sure did.
What did he do to get you on there? Were you performing in his act or opening for him? Or?
No, it was one Saturday night, Red Foley, who was one of the big stars and the star of the Prince Albert, which was the network show. Wife had died, and Hank had took the host position on the show, and he wanted me for his guest. And you didn't get on the Grand Ole Opry back then without a hit record, and I was years away from a hit record. So, but he got me on, and they sent me to take care of him on a trip one time, and everything worked out all right, so they signed me to a contract.
What do you mean they sent you to take care of him on a trip? They knew that he was having problems and he needed kind of like a guardian?
Yeah, and they needed somebody to get up and sing in case he didn't make it, and that was hard to do. That happened to me in Norfolk on New Year's Day, and I didn't know what to do because they come running in and said, well, you're going to have to take Hank's place. And here I was. Nobody even knew who I was. And I said, well, there's no way I can do that. But anyway, they put me out there with Hank's band, and we made it all right. And the people kind of liked me because I had made a mistake by naming one of the songs in a higher key than I ought to have been. And I let them know about it. So it turned kind of amusing for a while. And from then on, Norfolk was one of the best towns for me.
How would you explain it to the audience that Hank Williams couldn't make it?
Well, you let the promoter do that. And there were other stars on the show, Johnny and Jack and Kitty Wells, and we were all trying to cover up the fact because it was 10 or 12,000 people there. And the promoter went out and I forget what he said, that Hank was ill or something. But some of the times, Hank wouldn't even be drinking, and the promoters would get him to drinking so they didn't have to pay him.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding, honey.
So this way they'd get all the ticket sales, but they wouldn't have to pay him.
Well, they wouldn't have to pay him because he breached his contract. He'd come in there and got drunk, didn't do a good show. But they'd put him on the stage while he's inebriated, and nobody can get on the stage and sing drunk.
Uh-huh. But in the meanwhile, the promoter would have had maybe a full house and made all the money
on
the ticket
sale. $50,000 or $60,000, put in his pocket and go home.
Huh. Let's pause here for some music and hear one of your early hits. In fact, this was your first number one recording. This is called Crazy Arms. It was recorded in 1956. Do you want to say anything about the recording before we hear it?
Well, yeah. It was in 1956, and Bob Martin, a disc jockey in Tampa, Florida, had found a record of Crazy Arms. I mean, it wasn't a very good record. But he was intrigued by the song, and he played it for me, and I was too. And then when I recorded it, it became a monster. It was my first million seller, and it crossed over. And at that time, they didn't know what a crossover was. But it was the first big one I had, you're right.
Let's hear it. This is my guest, Ray Price, recorded in 1956.
No crazy dream I
the impact of having a number one hit?
Well, I got to eat pretty regular.
Were you having trouble doing that before?
Oh, yeah. All young ones have trouble. In fact, Lefty Frizzell and I started out together. And we used to split a bowl of stew in Dallas when we were first starting. But everything got better, and like it always does. And I don't know, that's about all I can say. It was just, it gave me an opportunity to do things that I hadn't been able to do up to that point.
Now, I believe after Hank Williams died, you used his band for a while.
I used his band for about 2 years, and there's two or three of them that's passed on now, but the rest of them, we're all dear friends. But I got to sounding too much like Hank on records. And
mm-hmm.
It was because the music was so locked in, it had to sound like Hank. And we had to break up. And broke up in Grand Junction, Colorado, if I remember correctly.
Did you feel that your singing style changed when you got your own band?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How did it change?
Well, I went back to singing Texas style. And not the way Hank and the band played. He had no drums or anything like that. And, of course, I brought a Texas swing band to Nashville to go to work with me. And from then on, that's the way it was. That's where I earned the title as the number one honky-tonk player. Because that's the only place you could play at that time was in the nightclubs.
We mentioned Western Swing. You did an album, I think it was in the late 1950s, of songs that were first recorded by Bob Wills, the kind of father of Western Swing. Did you ever know him?
Oh, yeah, I knew Bob real well. When I was first starting in Dallas, he had a nightclub called Bob Wills Ranch House. It later became another nightclub after he left it. But when he was on the road with his band, he would always let me and a band play in his place. He did me a big favor. And, of course, that was my tribute to him, was that album.
Well, this album features the band that you put together after you used the Hank Williams band, or one of the versions of the band you put together, and Willie Nelson is in this band. You had several really great people in your band. Johnny Bush was in your band for a while, the great singer.
Roger Miller was the front man.
Yeah. How did you find these people who became so famous in their own right? How did you end up having them as sidemen in your band?
Well, they were all looking for a job, Terry. Everything was tough back there. And I hired Roger. He was working in the fire department in Amarillo, Texas. And I needed a fiddle player, and he came out to play fiddle. And his fiddle playing was terrible. And when he got through, he said, "How'd you like that?" And I said, "Well, can you sing and play guitar?" And it kind of shook him, and he said, "Yeah." So I hired him as a front man.
Huh.
And he did real well. Roger and I were real close, just like Willie and I are still close.
Well, it sounded like you were determined to hire him, whether he was good or not.
Well, I had heard him sing.
Oh, okay, yeah,
you know,
yeah. And had you heard Willie Nelson sing before you hired him?
Well, Willie worked for my publishing company, Pamper Music.
Oh, so you knew his songs.
Oh, yeah, all of them. And, of course, Willie was having a hard time, too. And Johnny Paycheck had gone out on his own, and Willie replaced Johnny Paycheck on bass, and then he would play guitar sometimes.
So let's hear something from this Bob Wills tribute album, the one where Willie Nelson's featured in the band. And I just looked at the recording date on this. It was recorded in 1961, and I thought we'd hear Time Changes Everything. You want to say anything about it?
Just a great song.
It is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Here we go.
Country-wise.
This is Ray Price.
There was a time when I thought of no other, and we sang our own love's refrain. Our hearts beat as one as we had our fun, but time changes everything. When you left me,
my poor heart was broken. Our romance seemed all in vain. The dark clouds are gone and there's blue skies again. Our time changes everything.
That's Ray Price from his 1961 album, San Antonio Rose. It's a tribute to Bob Wills, and it's been reissued in the past couple of years. Was that Willie Nelson singing harmony, by the way?
Could have been. Now, Willie and I recorded a San Antonio Rose album in around 1979, I think.
And that was a big hit on the country charts.
It was a big one, real big.
Yeah. I know that there's a lot of country music performers who are, you know, acknowledged as being, you know, the among the greats, who don't get played much on country music radio anymore, including Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson. Do you feel that you're in that predicament as well?
Well, yeah, I'm in the same box. That all is brought down from the higher-ups in the industry, which I guess would be New York or L.A., and they felt like they could make a whole lot of money, more money with the young kids playing rock music, but they had to name it something besides rock or it wouldn't sell. And so they named it country music, but it's really rock music. It's the old Beatles sound.
So I take it it's a sound you don't much like or don't feel that you perform
anyways.
Beatles.
I like the Beatles. I think they ought to play the Beatles. They don't need to play the rest of them. The Beatles have already done it. Now, that sounds hateful, and I'm sorry for that.
In the mid-60s or so, you started using more heavily arranged settings, you know, strings and orchestras, moving away from a more honky-tonk kind of sound. What led you in that direction?
The honky-tonks.
What do you mean?
Yeah, it wasn't fun playing honky-tonks, and I was trying to broaden my audience out. Also, I thought that if country music was going to really win approval all over the country, they had to do something to kind of fix it where the people that listened to the Tony Bennett's and the Frank Sinatra's and those people would like the song or the music. And country music songs are great. I think they're beautiful songs. And to put the strings with them, that's my idea of how to make one really great song.
Did that work for you? Did it get you where you wanted to be in venues that other pop singers were singing?
Well, it got me on a lot of places, yeah. Sure did. I became one of Johnny Carson's favorite singers, which I'm very proud of. And I did a lot of things with him in New York before he moved to California and afterwards. But, yeah, it got me where I wanted to be, and I got out of the honky-tonks, and I still play dances every now and then for some of my old fans, but I'm not really into that anymore.
Ray Price speaking with Terry Gross in 1999. Next month, the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville opens an exhibit devoted to his life and music.
Tonight in a bar room I'm sitting, apart from the laughter and the cheer. The scenes of my life pass before me while watching the bubbles in my beer. A vision of someone who loved me brings a lone silent tear to my eye. A failure, just watching the bubbles in my beard.